enter or leave the islands, will be sunk. When our troops are in position, power will be shut off throughout the island, so there will be no communication on the island or to those outside of it. Only our facility will be powered. The government will be put under arrest and imprisoned, while our troops move in and capture the whole of their puny police force. They will be locked in their own jail with the men they have arrested, which should make for some entertaining moments. One of our advance groups will seize the country's sole radio station, from which I will, the next morning, address the people and introduce them to their new state of affairs. Every citizen will be required to register with our internal police board. Those who resist will be locked into our prison and sent through our re-education process. In the meantime, the Ohm and the Volta, with a contingent of 200 guards, will dock on the island of Nanumonga, which will be cleared out of all inhabitants. This is where we will build our new laboratories and weapons production facilities. Hatch looked around the room. Are there any questions? No one spoke. All right, then. Quentin and Torsten with me. The rest of you may retire for the evening. It's been a long day. Get some rest. We have much to do over the next 5 weeks. While the rest of the youth and board retired to their rooms, Hatch, accompanied by two guards, led Quentin and Torsten to the chairman's suite. The guards opened the door, and once inside, Hatch picked up the room phone. "Send housekeeping to the Admiral's suite immediately." Pause. "Yes, the chairman's suite. Thank you." He set down the phone, then lifted a crystal decanter of scotch, poured three glasses, then brought them over to the table on a silver platter. He offered the glasses to the teens, and they each took one. Quentin started to raise it to his lips, but Hatch stopped him. "Just a moment, Quentin. Have I taught you nothing? Never imbibe before you know what you are about to imbibe. This pretentious little draught is the Balvenie 50, a rare 50-year-old specimen of one of the finest single malt scotches ever distilled. A single bottle retails at more than $30,000. So what I poured you there is a $3,000 taste. Therefore it behooves us, out of decency and respect for the beverage, that we should thank former Chairman Skemmer for his fine taste in scotch." Hatch lifted his glass. "To Skemmer, a buffoon who knew his drink." They all raised their shots. Hatch closed his eyes as he drank, then set the glass down. "Worth every penny." Quentin choked a little on the drink, which made Torsten smile. Hatch looked at the teens. "I invited you here to mark this occasion," he said. "A day which will live in infamy. Today marks the beginning of a new world order. The world is changing, my friends. The autonomy of nations is already slipping from their citizens' grasps, and they don't even know it. It is self-evident that the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite is preferable to the archaic and outdated design of democracy. The belief that the average human, steeped in superstition and religious conditioning, has the ability to make rational decisions for society's governance is beyond ridiculous. It is unabashed stupidity. Today, we have taken the conclusive step toward world government. I don't mean in the pantomime, impotent sense of a League of Nations. Rather, an elite overclass prepared to rescue the dumb masses from themselves. You, my two apprentices, will someday take this gauntlet from me. You shall rule the world, and the world will be better for it. So let us mark this momentous occasion with a toast. Hatch again filled their glasses.
To the Elgen elite.
To the Elgen elite, they echoed. All three downed their drinks. Chapter 15. The Dragon and Its Beast. Just minutes after the toast, there was a knock on the door.
How's he keeping?
Come in, Hatch said. The door slowly opened, and a portly middle-aged Italian woman in a white and turquoise housekeeping smock looked in timidly.
Chairman Schema?
Mr. Schema doesn't live here anymore, Hatch said. I'm your new boss. Is it just you?
Yes, sir.
What is your name?
My name is a Patrizia.
Okay, Patrizia. You'd better call for help. This room reeks of Schema. I want you to disinfect it. I want it scrubbed from top to bottom. I want you to change my linens, rugs, and towels. In short, I want you to sterilize or replace every piece of fabric, including the drapes. You may begin by removing Mr. Schema's personal belongings from the closets and drawers. The maid looked confused.
Where shall I take the chairman's things?
He is no longer the chairman, and you are not to refer to him by that title any more. Do you understand? She swallowed.
Yes, sir.
I don't care what you do with his personal artifacts. He rubbed his chin, then said,
No, actually, I do.
Throw them overboard. I don't like clutter, and he won't be needing them any more. She looked around at the beautiful art.
Everything, sir?
Everything. Now call your colleagues and get to work. I want you done and out of my room in 2 hours. A minute longer and you'll spend the night with the former chairman in the brig. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
Very well, get to it. Hatch turned back. He took another drink. Quentin, I want you to make sure everyone's accommodations are acceptable. Yes, sir. Go to it. When you're done, report to me on the forward deck. He stood. Yes, sir. Go along with him, Torsten. Yes, sir. The maid had already called the rest of the housekeeping crew and was working frantically, piling the linens in the center of the room. Hatch smiled to see her so motivated. He grabbed the bottle of scotch and walked to the door. He turned back to the frantic woman. 1 hour, 58 minutes, Patrizia. I've set a timer. I will be back then. Hopefully you won't be escorted out by one of my guards.
Yes, sir,
she said, too frantic even to look at him. Hatch walked out of the room. Hatch took the elevator to the bridge level and walked out onto the deck, the pungent smell of sea spray filling his nostrils. He sat down near the bow, kicking his feet up on the chair next to him. He lifted the scotch and took a swig, then set the bottle down next to the chair. He had been there for about 30 minutes when Quentin walked out to him. Everyone is happy with their room, sir.
Where is Torsten?
He's in his room.
Very well, Hatch said.
He was still looking out over the water.
Q?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever read the Bible?
Quentin's brow furrowed. No, sir. It wasn't allowed at the academy.
That's a shame.
He turned to Quentin.
It's fabulous fiction, really.
Hogwash, of course, rubbish and drivel.
But every now and then, the writers got it right. Did you know that it prophesizes of us?
I didn't know that, sir.
2 millennia ago, they wrote of our day.
Hatch looked back out over the water. And I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power, his throne, and great authority, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him. He took another drink from the bottle, then turned back toward Quentin. The 7 heads and 10 horns, the number 17, represents the 17 electric children. And the dragon gave them their power, as I have given you yours, just as I will give you thrones and great authority. And the people of this world shall fear you, and they shall worship me. He smiled. By the time they know who we are, it will be too late. He laughed. I'm rather prosaic tonight, wouldn't you say?
Yes, sir, Quentin said.
Or maybe I'm just drunk.
Quentin looked down. About the 17, what of the others?
The other glows, they'll come around, he said. Eventually. Even Michael Vey. If I have learned one thing from life, it is that you can't fight destiny.
Quentin bit down on his cheek. Yes, sir. Do you need anything else, sir?
To be left alone, Hatch said.
Yes, sir. Requesting permission to retire to my room.
Get out of here, Hatch said.
Quentin turned and went back inside. Hatch looked out over the setting sun. He held up his thumb, covering the halved red-orange orb. Then he lifted the bottle again.
To the dragon, he said, and his fearsome young beasts.
It was after dark when Hatch carried what was left of the Scotch down to the brig. The engines were being serviced, so the bottom-level corridor was quiet for a change. The guards outside the cells saluted and stood at attention at Hatch's approach.
Admiral, sir.
At ease, sailors, Hatch said. He handed out his bottle. Have a drink.
We're on duty, sir, they both said.
Right answer, he said.
Here, he said to the closest guard, hold my bottle.
At Hatch's appearance, the crowded board members all stood, their hands still tied behind their backs, everyone except for Skemma, who had been tied upside down by his feet to the outer bars, his back toward Hatch. He had been hanging for more than 3 hours and was unconscious. There was a pool of vomit on the floor beneath him. Two pressed against the bars.
Cut him down, Hatch, she said. I demand it.
Hatch looked at her incredulously.
Did I hear you right? You demand it?
His eyes narrowed on her.
Is that really what you said?
Two swallowed, her look of indignation quickly evaporating. Hatch smiled.
You, numero dos, are in no position to demand anything.
He moved his face next to the bars.
And the next time you make such an imperious statement, you will join 10, bobbing for kelp in the Tyrrhenian Sea. Do you understand me?
she began trembling.
Yes. Yes, what? Yes, sir.
Yes, Admiral, Hatch corrected. He looked at the rest of the prisoners, who were cowed against the back wall of the cell. If any of you get that wrong again, you will regret it for the rest of your greatly diminished life. From this moment on, you will only address me as Admiral Hatch. He started to turn.
Admiral,
Two said. Hatch turned back. She knelt down and bowed her head until it touched the floor of the cell.
Please, Admiral. Please release the former chairman. He won't live much longer like this.
Hatch looked at her with intrigue.
So I wasn't wrong. You do care about him.
She looked up. Tears were streaming down her cheeks.
Yes, Admiral.
You have feelings for him?
She swallowed.
Yes, Admiral.
Do you love him?
She hesitated, caught up by her emotion.
Yes, Admiral.
Hatch started to laugh.
Oh, my!
After a moment, he said,
How much?
What?
How much do you love him?
She looked at Hatch fearfully, certain that his question was a trap.
With all my heart.
With all your heart?
Hatch laughed.
I've seen your heart, lady, and there's not much there.
She didn't answer, but bowed her head. Hatch exhaled.
Okay, you say you love him. I'll have him cut down.
He flourished his hand.
For love's sake.
She looked up in surprise.
Thank you, Admiral. Thank you.
As long as you agree to take his place.
Her expression turned from relief to horror.
For love's sake, Hatch said.
His eyes narrowed.
Or doesn't your love go that far?
She hesitated a moment, then said,
Yes, Admiral, it does. Thank you for your kindness.
Hatch looked at her for a moment, then shrugged.
Surprising.
He turned to the guard.
Make it so.
Yes, sir.
Hatch shook his head as he reclaimed his bottle. Then he said,
All you need is love.
He turned and walked back down the corridor, humming.
Part 4 Chapter 16 Against the Current Jaime, Tessa, and I continued our hike west through heavy jungle for 2 more days. At times, the silence between us seemed as stifling as the jungle's humidity. Jaime was angry. He was breaking orders and was leading me only because I had threatened to expose the voice if he didn't. Tessa still hadn't changed her mind about helping me rescue my friends, though I was pretty certain she felt guilty about it. Late afternoon of the second day, Jaime led us up the steep slope of another hill, then abruptly stopped and dropped his pack on the ground.
This is where we will camp for the night.
It's not even dark yet, I said.
Come with me, he said.
I followed him to a break in the trees.
There, he said,
pointing to a mountain on the opposite side of the river.
That is our destination. It is close. We can make it by tomorrow.
If it's close, then we should keep going, I said. The army could move them at any time. They could be traveling right now.
No, Jaime said, shaking his head. If they are traveling right now, then it is already too late. We do not want to cross the river at night. There are things in the river that feed most at night, and we cannot make a fire to warm or dry ourselves after we swim. It is best that we wait until the morning. Once we reach the hill, I will make radio contact again. I will ask our people to tell us about the movements of the army."
I looked back out over the river. "All right," I finally said. I had to give him credit. In spite of his disagreement with my plans, he had been more helpful than he had to be. I think that secretly, despite his orders, he wanted me to rescue my friends. "Thank you." He looked at me with worried eyes.
"Tell me that after you do not die."
Food was running low. All we had left from Jaime's camp was some beef jerky, dried banana chips, and hard rolls with packages of soft cheese. While Tessa and I set up the tent, Jaime left us to look for food. He returned about an hour later with a lumpy backpack. He laid the pack down and fruit spilled out. Tessa held up an egg-sized fruit with dark purple scales. "What's this?" she asked.
"It is the aguaje," Jaime said. "It is delicious and very good for you."
She peeled back the fruit's skin and took a bite. "It tastes like a carrot."
"It is very popular," Jaime said. "Women who live near the rainforest eat it very often. They say it makes them more beautiful."
"I feel more beautiful already," Tessa said sarcastically. Jaime handed me a different fruit. It was yellow and shaped like a bell pepper.
"This is the cocona. It is also called the Amazon tomato. It is not sweet, but good to eat."
I took a bite. Its taste fell somewhere between a lime and a tomato. I ate until I had finished the fruit, then wiped the juice dripping down my chin. "Thank you," I said. "Was this hard to find?"
"Not so hard, but you must know what to look for. There are many fruits in the jungle, but much of it is poisonous."
We finished eating, then set up our camp. It was the earliest that we had gone to bed since we'd started our journey. I woke early the next morning. Tessa was still asleep, her soft breath rhythmically filling the tent. Jaime was gone again. I sat up, then crawled toward the tent opening. It was dawn, and a new sun had begun its climb over the jungle canopy, painting a baby blue sky with creamsicle orange clouds. Jaime had nearly finished packing up the camp except for our tent. He looked over at me. "Good morning," I said.
"Buenos dias," he replied. "Have some fruit."
"Thank you," I said. "You've already packed up."
"Si. We should get an early start."
"How long have you been up?"
"Maybe 2 hours. I went down to the river to watch for El Gen patrols. One boat went by an hour ago."
I held up a piece of brown fruit. "This is new," I said, examining the avocado-sized fruit.
"The piton," Jaime said. "I found it this morning."
"It looks like a mango."
"It is a wild mango."
"I love mangoes," I said. "The greatest fruit ever invented." Tessa crawled out of the tent. "What's the greatest fruit ever invented?" I held up the fruit. "The mango." "I love mangoes," she said, "especially in smoothies with sweetened condensed milk." "That's not going to happen," I said.
"Eat it all," Jaime said. "We cannot carry much across the river."
"We're crossing the river today?" Tessa asked.
"Si, señorita."
"Good. That means we're getting close." We finished eating, then Tessa and I packed up our tent, and we all hiked down to the river. Before coming out into the open of the riverbank, Jaime looked for several minutes through his binoculars, then set them down.
"It is time to cross the river."
"Where's the boat?" Tessa asked.
"There is no boat," Jaime said.
Then how do we cross?
We swim.
She looked at him in disbelief. You're kidding, right?
No, I am not kidding.
I don't swim. I almost drowned in a hot tub once. I turned to Jaime.
We've got a problem. There is no other way across the river.
You can't swim? I asked. I don't swim well, she replied. And this isn't a swimming pool. It's a big, scary, muddy river with things in it that eat people. Why can't we just take a bridge?
There is not a bridge for 100 kilometers, Jaime said.
Then let's get a boat. I mean, how are you going to take the radio across?
I have a waterproof bag. I will carry it across.
You should put me in a waterproof bag and carry me across, she said. What if we found a log and floated across? I said.
We do not have time, Jaime said.
I don't think we have a choice, I said. Tessa, will that work? There's still all those creatures in there. What if they're attracted by our glow?
The jungle people swim in the river all the time, Jaime said. It is safer than crossing a street in Los Angeles.
Not real comforting, Tessa said. I looked Tessa in the eyes.
Come on, we'll be okay. I'll be right beside you.
She looked exasperated. All right. Just make sure it's a really big log.
We'll do our best.
Jaime and I went into the jungle, and after 10 minutes of looking, found a log about 7 feet long. In spite of its size, it was very light, like balsa wood.
This will work, Jaime said. This is the kapok tree. Natives make boats out of it.
We carried the log to the river's bank. Then Jaime secured the radio in his waterproof bag, leaving as much air in the bag as possible before sealing it shut. Then we fastened all our packs to the log and pushed it part way into the river.
Remember, Jaime said, the current is strong. You must swim hard with the log.
He waded into the dark water, holding the radio in front of him.
Vamanos!
He shouted, and then he plunged into the water on top of the bag and began kicking fiercely as the water's current grabbed hold of him. Let's go, I said to Tessa. Tessa glanced at me fearfully, but still walked forward toward the log. I'll get in front, I said. No, she said. Get behind me, in case I let go.
Don't let go, I said.
Like I'm going to on purpose, she said. It's a log. There's no handles. I moved behind her. Here, just hold on to the pack straps. It will be easier than holding the log. Okay, okay. She stepped into the water. It's gross and dirty. So are we, I said. Come on, let's get it over with. We heaved the log into the river. The log submerged with us in tow, then quickly popped up again. Tessa clung tightly to the straps. She was terrified. I hate water, she shouted, dripping and sputtering.
You and Zeus, I said.
Don't put us in the same sentence, she replied. The current pulled us about 20 feet out into the river, then swept us forward.
We've got to swim hard to get across, I shouted.
How do I swim and hold on?
Just kick!
We both kicked as hard as we could, but made little headway against the powerful current. Jaime was 20 yards downstream from us, but was already approaching the opposite bank. We were having more difficulty as the log put us at the mercy of the river.
Más rápido!
Jaime shouted to us.
Swim more fast!
We both kept kicking as hard as we could. We were quickly becoming waterlogged as the river repeatedly washed up over us and our log.
Keep going, I said. We're almost halfway there.
I realized that by the time we reached the opposite shore, we were going to be separated from Jaime by several hundred yards. Although he was only 10 feet from the opposite bank, Jaime was still swimming, trying to keep up with us. Suddenly, Tessa screamed.
What's that?
What?
In front of us!
I looked forward. There was another log ahead of us, except it wasn't moving downstream.
It's just a log, I said. It must be stuck on something.
I don't think it's a log.
I looked again. It wasn't a log. It was a massive caiman.
Oh, crap.
Michael!
Climb up on the log,
I shouted. We both tried, but the log just rolled back with us, dunking us underneath the water. After our third attempt, Tessa shouted,
I can't!
She turned back.
It's coming! Jaime!
I shouted.
Caiman! Caiman!
He was far enough away that he looked at us without comprehension.
Get your gun!
I pointed toward the approaching caiman. Jaime began swimming toward the bank.
Michael!
Tessa screamed. She closed her eyes as the caiman opened its mouth just 5 feet in front of her.
Enhance me!
I shouted.
Give me everything!
I pulsed the hardest I ever had. So hard, in fact, that the water around me actually sizzled. The reptile shook violently, then turned sideways and sank. Suddenly, all around us, fish began popping up on the river's surface. They were everywhere, dozens of them.
I'm going to faint, Tessa said.
Don't do that, I said. Just keep kicking.
It was another 10 minutes before we were close to the opposite bank. Jaime had abandoned the radio and ran down the side of the riverbank to help us. He waded into the river up to his shoulders and grabbed the front of the log and pulled us into shore. Tessa and I stumbled up to dry ground, then fell to our knees, exhausted. After she'd caught her breath, Tessa screamed at Jaime,
"Don't you ever make me do that again!"
"Señorita..."
Don't you señorita me, she shouted. I almost got eaten by a crocodile.
Caiman, I said.
Sorry, he said.
Yeah, I bet you are, she said.
Jaime looked at me sheepishly. Tessa took off her shoes and poured the water out of them, then put them back on and stood up.
Vamanos, she said.
I looked at Jaime and shrugged. We were wet and uncomfortable, and the hike from the river to the top of the mountain took us 6 more hours. The one good thing was that by the time we reached our destination, our clothes were mostly dry, at least as dry as one can hope for when hiking through a tropical rainforest. From the mountain peak, I could see the highway stretching east and west for at least 5 miles in both directions before it disappeared into the jungle. I could see why Jaime chose this point to attack. The roadway was steep and rugged, and the jungle seemed to spill over the asphalt as if attempting to reclaim the road. Jaime looked out toward the east with his binoculars, then handed them to me.
That is the direction they will come from.
I lifted the binoculars and looked out over the fading ribbon of asphalt. Are you sure this is the only way they can get to Lima?
See, this is the road they came on. I saw them. The road will go through Cusco, then west to Lima.
Is it possible that they've already passed? I asked.
No. Look closely. There is fruit and dead animals on the road that are not flat. That many trucks would not miss anything.
I looked out again and could see that he was right. There was some pretty bloated-looking roadkill. I handed him back his binoculars.
Thank you. We will make camp, then radio the voice, and see what he knows.
We set up our camp a little off the peak on a mild downhill slope where the canopy was thicker. As we had no idea how many days we would be waiting, we took the time to carefully conceal our camp, gathering banana leaves and palm fronds to cover our tent. Jaime created a trip line of vines that would warn us if someone was near. The sun was fading in the west when we finally stopped to eat dinner. Jaime handed us some reddish-orange pods he had cut open with his knife. The inside of the fruit was white, like boiled lobster, with a dark bean in the center.
"I've never seen this," Tessa said.
"It's cacao," Jaime said.
"Chocolate."
"Finally something decent," Tessa said.
"It will not taste like a chocolate bar," Jaime said.
He pulled out some of the beans.
"You suck the flesh off of the cacao bean. Then you chew the bean."
Tessa and I followed his lead. The fruit surrounding the bean was actually quite good, but the bean itself was bitter, with only a vague semblance of chocolate flavor.
"This isn't chocolate," Tessa said, clearly disappointed.
"It is what chocolate is made from," Jaime said.
"Could have fooled me," she said, spitting out the seed. "You can have this," I said, giving her the last piton. We finished eating, then we gathered around the radio that Jaime had concealed behind our tent. We were high enough up that I didn't need to climb any trees to mount an antenna. I didn't need to power the radio either. Apparently, I had sufficiently recharged the batteries during our previous transmission. Jaime flipped a switch, and the lights of the radio came on. He handed me a headphone. The crisp crackle of static drowned out the jungle symphony.
"I want to listen," Tessa said.
"I only have 2 headphones," Jaime said.
"I'll share," I said. I flipped the 2 earpieces around, and Tessa sat next to me, both of us holding a speaker to one of our ears. Jaime dialed a number, then said,
"Lightning Rod, this is Southern Cross, over."
Nothing came back. Jaime signaled again.
"Lightning Rod, this is..."
He was interrupted by 3 beeps. Then a female voice said,
"Southern Cross, we read you. Please confirm."
10-1-1-9-6-2.
"Please repeat the last 2 numbers."
"No," he said.
"Confirmed," the woman said. "One moment, please."
There was a pause. Then the voice said,
"Southern Cross, are you still in possession of the jewels?"
"Yes."
"We are pleased to hear that. At least not everything has gone wrong."
"What do you mean?"
Jaime asked.
"Things have taken a turn for the worse. Hatch has gained control of the Elgen. He has imprisoned the chairman and commandeered the Elgen fleet."
"Que piña! It could not be worse."
"Our source has learned that Hatch plans to secure a land base so the Elgen can train soldiers and ultimately build weapons of mass destruction."
"Weapons of mass destruction?" I said. "You mean nuclear weapons?"
"No," the voice answered. "The Elgen are developing high-potency EMPs.
"I know about EMPs," Tessa said. "Quentin is an EMP. He can shut down machines and stuff."
"That is right," the voice said. "A powerful enough EMP device could create an electromagnetic pulse that could conceivably shut down all electrical devices for many thousands of miles."
"Then EMPs don't kill people," I said.
"They will most definitely kill people," the voice replied. "It's estimated that up to 10% of the population would die immediately. If you destroy all electrical devices, you shut down hospitals and all health devices. Anyone on life support would die."
"But hospitals have backup generators," Tessa said.
"An EMP doesn't just stop the source of power, it permanently destroys all electronic circuitry. Lights won't work, cars won't run. Communication will be shut down, including all cell phones and radios. Gas stations won't be able to pump gas. Grocery stores will lose refrigeration. Food will rot, and people will starve. All business will be brought to a standstill. There will be riots in the streets and looting. It is believed that an EMP may, in the long run, produce as many casualties as a nuclear weapon.
How long would it take to get power again? I asked.
The problem is, the machinery required to repair or rebuild the infrastructure is also powered by electricity. It might not be possible for a country to rebuild itself.
That's incredibly stupid, Tessa said.
It's short-sighted, the voice replied. But electricity has always been the Achilles heel of the modern world.
How will that benefit the Elgen? I asked.
The Elgen will offer aid by helping to rebuild the country's electrical grid to run off their star source plants, ultimately putting them in complete control of the world's power and economy.
Where is this land Hatch plans to conquer?
Jaime asked. Hatch's target is a small country in the South Pacific called Tuvalu. The Elgen have already been there for more than a year and have already constructed a star source plant as large as the Peruvian facility that will serve as their administrative building and re-education center.
Doesn't the country have an army to defend itself? I asked.
No. Tuvalu is the size of a small American city. All they have is a police force, and there are more than 100 Elgen guards to every police officer. The Elgen are also much better armed and trained. The Tuvaluans are a simple people. The Elgen will either slaughter them or turn them into their workforce.
You mean they'll make them slaves? I said.
Very likely, the voice said.
Que lío!
Jaime said.
They are pure evil.
The location of Tuvalu is strategic. It will give the Elgen unrestricted access to Hawaii, Australia, Taiwan, China, India, the Philippines, and Japan.
This is most horrible news,
Jaime said, rubbing his forehead.
What can be done to stop them?
We have leaked information to the leaders of Tuvalu, but it's falling on deaf ears. The Elgen have just solved the country's power shortage and are being heralded as heroes. But we have one other chance to stop them. Prior to their attack, the Elgen fleet is sailing to the port of Callao, west of Lima, to pick up the remainder of their force still quartered in Puerto Maldonado. There are thousands of guards stranded after the attack of the Star Source plant. They will also be refueling and stocking up on supplies. We estimate that it will take them 4 or 5 days to complete their preparations, but once they have left the port, there will be no stopping them. We must strike before they leave.
What are your orders? Jaime asked.
Sink the Ampere while it's in port.
What's the Ampere? I asked. It's the Elgen super yacht, Tessa said. I've been on it. It's very cool. It has a helipad, sushi bar. It even has a disco.
The Ampere is the Elgen command base, the voice said. It's where Hatch operates from.
How are we supposed to sink a ship? I asked.
You and your friends destroyed their largest and most secure star source plant. We're confident that you can sink a ship.
Yeah, well, I don't have my friends with me, I said. And the last time we spoke, you told me not to go after them.
We were only protecting you, the voice said. We believed that the chance of your success against their army was less than the chance of our success. But that's before Hatch took over. Now we are certain that we have no chance of diplomacy. The Elgen will be pressuring the Peruvian government for blood. You need to rescue your friends. Jaime, do all in your power to assist Michael in this cause. Call in assistance if you have to.
Yes, sir. Do you know where the others are?
They are still being held in Puerto Maldonado. They nearly escaped but were recaptured outside the compound. Our sources tell us that the army is preparing right now to move them to Lima. So if you expect to breach their compound, you'll have to move fast.
We have a different plan, Jaime said. There is a narrow highway they will have to pass through on the way to Lima. We believe it is a place where we could stop them. We just need to know when they are moving.
Very well. We'll alert you when the army is moving.
And then what? I asked.
After you have rescued your friends, We will instruct you on everything we know about the Elgen fleet and the Ampere. Is there anything else you need right now?
I want to speak with my mother.
I'll arrange for you to talk. I will give you a time during our next communication.
Wait, I have a question, Tessa said, leaning forward toward the microphone. Do you know anything about the Amakara? Are they okay?
There was a long pause. The Amakara tribe no longer exists.
Tessa turned white. What do you mean?
The army massacred the tribe for harboring terrorists.
Tessa's eyes welled up with tears.
No!
I'm sorry. The army has been ruthless.
I put my hand on Tessa's back. Tessa grabbed her beads, and tears began falling down her face.
My mama.
There was a long pause.
Then the voice said, I'm sorry, but we must sign out. There is one more thing you must know. We have been compromised.
Now Jaime turned white.
How?
The army learned of our existence while interrogating the others. They passed it on to the Elgen. They don't know who or where we are, but they know that we exist. We have called a few of our agents in the field to come in.
This cannot be true,
Jaime said, putting his hand over his eyes.
I wish it weren't. We will contact you when the army starts to move. Over.
The radio went dead. I took the headphone and gave it back to Jaime. The dread was palpable. It was as if a bomb had just gone off in our midst. Jaime was the first to speak.
They know of us, he said, slowly shaking his head.
I looked at Tessa. She was sobbing.
I'm sorry, I said, returning my hand to her back. They were so innocent, she said.
She covered her eyes with her hand. I didn't know what to say. I just kept rubbing her back. After a few minutes, her sobbing slowed, turning to a soft whimper. Then she stopped completely. She held her hands at her temples, her fingers digging into her hair. Then she looked up at me. Her eyes were red and swollen.
They're going to pay for this. We're going to make them pay.
Chapter 17 Rock Slide. After all the bad news we'd just received, the next few days passed in misery. We were low on food, and edible fruit was not very plentiful where we were camped. Now that we were close to the road, Jaime didn't dare go out foraging.
Too risky, he said.
He told us that the army would likely send out an advance patrol before they moved. The second day, it rained hard, and for most of the day, we just sat in our tent, with nothing to do but sleep to escape the malaise. Jaime acted calm, but I could tell that he was going crazy inside. Tessa was not as stoic. She broke down crying at least a dozen times. The Amakara tribe was the closest thing to family she had. Early in the morning of the third day, the rain finally stopped, and Jaime led us down the rugged terrain of the south side of the mountain near the highway. We needed to scout the pass to make our plans. The road was covered on both sides by thick forest, which would be advantageous to us. The biggest question we faced was how to stop an army. Actually, we didn't need to stop all of the trucks, just the ones in front, creating a traffic jam. The problem was, anything obvious might look like an attack, and surprise was vital. If 4,000 soldiers dug in for battle, we were through. For nearly an hour, we crouched down in the jungle, looking out over the highway, away from the road, in case an army patrol drove by.
How many trucks do you think there will be? I asked Jaime.
Many, he said.
Like how many? I asked. 20? 30?
Maybe 200
or more.
200? How will we know what truck they're being kept in?
Jaime shook his head.
It will not be a simple thing.
I can find them,
Tessa said. I turned to her. How?
I can sense electricity. That's how I knew you were electric when I met you. It's the same way Nichelle sensed powers.
Nichelle could sense powers?
If she didn't, she wouldn't be able to feed off your electricity. Hatch once had us walk through the academy blindfolded to find the electric kids. Nichelle and I are really not that different.
Believe me, you're different.
Personality-wise, she said, Nichelle's all goth and all that, but the scientists at the academy said we were similar in physiology. Nichelle was better at finding electricity than I was, but I can still do it. I just need to get closer than she did.
How close?
Maybe 30 feet.
I looked at the lush jungle encroaching on the road. That will work. We stop the convoy, then we'll move along behind the trees until you feel something.
Then what? Tessa asked.
I shock the guards, we open the trucks, and we free my friends.
How do we stop the trucks?
The question is, how do we do it without causing suspicion?
Look, Jaime said. That sign.
He pointed to a yellow diamond-shaped precaution sign that showed stones showering down on a road.
Falling rocks, I said.
We could roll large rocks into the road, Jaime said. They would think it was a rock slide and not suspect us.
He pointed to a rocky crag jutting out from the jungle.
There are rocks up there.
We followed Jaime back up the mountain. The terrace Jaime had seen from the road was littered with boulders from an earlier slide. Using a tree branch as a lever, we helped Jaime position a dozen or more large stones on the edge of the precipice.
When they come, we will push the mountain down in front of them, Jaime said.
Or on them, Tessa said.
Just as long as we stop them, I said. The terrace was also high enough that we could see the highway for several miles in either direction. This is a good lookout.
See,
Jaime said, sitting down on one of the rocks. I pointed down to where we had first descended. Tessa and I will wait there on the opposite side of the highway. After you stop them, we'll work our way down from behind the trees until we find them.
Then how do we get away? Tessa asked.
I looked back over the highway. If they're chasing us, we'll have to head down the mountain. It's thicker jungle on that side. We'll have a better chance of hiding and ambushing them.
Jaime nodded with approval. If we are separated, we will meet in Cusco, he said. There is a small hostel near the Plaza de Armas, the town square. It is owned by a friend of mine, and will be safe.
What's the name of the place? I asked.
Hostel El Triunfo, he said.
El Triunfo, I repeated, committing the name to memory. Jaime grinned.
Yes, the Triumph. If we make it, then it will be well named.
I didn't like his if. By noon we had hiked back to our camp. We had a lunch of what Jaime had scavenged on the way back, mostly berries and some weird pod fruit that tasted like boiled styrofoam. We also had snails, which Jaime had pulled from their shells and eaten raw. Tessa and I both tried one. I gagged, and she spit hers out. We decided to stick with the fruit. As the day waned, Tessa went back inside herself, silently fondling the red bead necklace her mother had given her when they'd said goodbye. I understood her anger. It's how I felt when Hatch took my mother. But I wondered if what had happened to her Amakara mother had rekindled deeper feelings about the loss of her real family. I wouldn't have been surprised. Around 8 o'clock, Tessa and I were just lying in the tent when we heard Jaime talking.
What's he doing? I asked.
Tessa sat up.
It sounds like there's someone out there.
We crawled out of the tent. Jaime was standing near the radio. In front of him were two Peruvian men. Between them were three large packs and a duffel bag. As we approached, they turned to look at us. "Who are these guys?" I asked Jaime.
"They are my amigos," Jaime said.
One of them started to put out his hand to me, then stopped.
"Me electrocutará?" he asked.
"Espero que no,"
Jaime turned to me.
"He's afraid you might shock him."
"I don't shock friends." I looked the man over, then said, "I'm assuming you're a friend." He put out his hand and said with a heavy accent,
"I am Javier."
"And this is Pablo,"
Jaime said, pointing to the other man. "I'm Michael. This is Tessa."
"Hermosa,"
Javier said, looking at Tessa.
"Beautiful girl."
Tessa didn't smile. She looked at Jaime. "What's going on? Why are they here?"
"We need more help. Sit down,"
he said, pointing to the ground. We all sat. Jaime said to Pablo,
"Necesito su mapa."
The man retrieved a map from his backpack and unfolded it on the ground before us. Jaime pulled a small penlight from his pocket and shined it on the map. The words on the map were in Spanish, but I guessed it was a map of where we were.
"Our camp is here," Jaime said, touching his finger to the paper.
He slid it down toward the single red line denoting the highway.
"This is where we put the rocks, and this is where we will stop the army. You will be here."
He pointed to a space across from the highway.
"Your friends will be somewhere along this road. As you look for them, we will be watching you with binoculars. After you have found them all, you will go south through the jungle. To keep the army from following you, we will make a distraction over here."
He touched a place about a quarter mile from where Tessa and I planned to start. "What kind of distraction?" I asked.
"My friends have brought three gun sentries like the ones I had at the camp. We will make them fire on the army. They will think they are being attacked from down there," he said, touching the map. "While we will go back over the mountain and escape on the river, you will go south through the jungle as fast as you can go. In a few days, we will find you and bring you to Cusco."
"How will you find us in the jungle?" I asked.
"With this."
He reached into the same backpack and brought out a small black iPod. "An iPod?" Tessa said.
"It is like the one we gave you before," he said to me. "This too has a GPS signal. It will tell us where you are. I will also give you a small radio, but I will not try to contact you right away. The army will be searching these mountains and listening for transmissions."
"What if you're caught?" Tessa said. "Then what will we do?"
"I have friends in Puerto Maldonado that will help you. They know the signal of your device."
I looked at Jaime's friends. They were looking at us intently, even though I doubted they understood a word of what Jaime was saying in English. "You're sure you can trust these guys?" I asked.
"With our lives," Jaime said. "They are proven. One more thing."
He walked over and picked up a backpack, then walked back to us.
"They have brought us food."
Jaime dropped the pack between us.
"Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you," Tessa said.
"Muchas gracias," I said to the men.
"Para servirle,"
the older of the men said.
"Eat much," Jaime said. "You will need your strength."
I reached into the pack and brought out two Inca colas, a round of cheese, hard-boiled eggs, many loaves of bread, some shish kebabs wrapped in foil, and some dip in plastic containers. We hadn't had protein in days, so after drinking some of our colas, we unwrapped the kebabs. The meat was dark and cold, but tasty.
"This is good," I said, stripping the meat off the skewer. "What is it?"
"Anticuchos de corazón," Jaime answered.
"Anti what?"
"Cow heart."
Tessa grimaced.
We're eating heart?
It's meat, I said. What's in here? I lifted one of the plastic containers.